Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip.
Dr. Mainu Simmons is an experienced consultant NHS child and adolescent psychiatrist working in Oxford, UK, and training programme director in child and adolescent psychiatry for Thames Valley, as well as a parent of three. Dr. Simmons qualified as a doctor from the University of Cambridge in 2004, then specialised in child and adolescent psychiatry and has worked with many hundreds of families with a broad range of mental health difficulties. She has a special interest in medical education and training and has taught and published on a range of topics. She is passionate about sharing her knowledge of children and young people's mental health.
A very warm welcome to this podcast. We're very excited to bring you a special guest, Dr. Mainu Simmons. How are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. It's a great privilege to speak to you in person because we're very familiar with your work at Tooled Up. And we know, Dr. Simmons, that you've published a fantastic guide to the mental health of children and young people. I think it was published by, or at least produced by, the Royal College of Psychiatrists.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So the college work in conjunction with Cambridge University Press. And when I first had the idea for the book, I contacted the college team and asked about the process. And they told me about the links with CUP. So that's how it progressed.
So it's a very substantial book, but the purpose of this interview is really to whet people's appetite, whether or not you're an educator or a carer or a parent. And, you know, I'm lucky to have a great copy with me here. And it is incredibly just, I think it's very important to just frame the discussion with why you wanted to write the book. I know that you've written about this, but tell us a little bit more about that decision.
Yeah, so I was aware that, having worked in the mental health field for some time, that actually there was a lot of increased awareness and really a thirst for more knowledge from the fellow parents and teachers as well. I've got various family members who are in the teaching profession and told me about their struggles in supporting children, young people, and there's no kind of training around mental health for teachers in teacher training college, and how they're often at the sharp end of having to provide support, and it's getting increasingly difficult to get kind of support through CAMHS just because of the volume of referrals coming through. And it is probably still one of the most underfunded parts of the NHS, and it has been for some time. And I thought, well, actually, I'm in quite a privileged position in that I've had these years of experience and training. Could I use my experience and also interest in education to then help to kind of just produce some kind of small contribution to helping people to understand a little bit more about what the underpinnings are around young people's mental health and how to offer that support? And I had the opportunity, so my third maternity leave, I kind of also wanted a bit of a space of keeping active in terms of professionally active, but having more than a year off kind of. So that's when I started the project. And then it took a few years from there, just kind of going, you know, as time went on, doing reviews and things like that. So it was a project that took a few years to finish, but actually it was a really interesting process myself as well. I learned a lot through doing it. And I'm just hoping that it can help to kind of give people a bit more of a sense of what the landscape in terms of young people's mental health is and where to get support and reliable ways to look up information as well. Because I guess one thing that I was seeing clinically as well is that a lot of parents were really struggling to know where to get reliable information. Now there's just been this explosion of information on the, you know, online. So how to get that, and thinking about ways that And I know that there, even though a lot of people do initially look online for resources, there is still my generation who still like to have a handbook that they can flick through. So it's just adding another resource to that, you know, to the field of information that's hopefully reliable and evidence-based.
And I think the way in which you've written the book is very helpful, because you could just take a chapter, you know, on a particular point, like sleep, and just dwell on that. You don't need to read it from cover to cover initially. So I think it's structured in a very, very nice way, in a very functional way. I wanted to start, I thought it was incredibly fruitful at the beginning of the book, where, and something I think that people don't dwell on enough, which is definitions around mental health. People sort of bandy about words like mental well-being, mental fitness, you know, mental health, well-being, you know, and nobody really thinks about how they logically intersect. So I was wondering if we could just spend a little bit of time. It's literally the first chapter. You're just defining mental well-being as opposed to mental fitness, as opposed to mental flourishing, as opposed to mental health, and extracting what we need to know as parents and educators about those definitions.
Yeah, and I don't want people to get too bogged down in the minutiae around the definitions, but how I see it is that we all, on a population level, we can all do things to maximise our mental well-being. And there is increasing evidence from parts of lifestyle medicine as well about things like sleep and all of these other factors and what an impact they can have on our mental well-being and our ability to function. And that's something that I really want to emphasise, that in mental health services, what we really try and focus on a lot is how is the young person functioning. And then in terms of kind of mental disorders and difficulties, what we are increasingly aware of now is that we're trying to move away from too much black box labels of saying this is a mental illness or disorder, because we're increasingly realizing that most things are on a spectrum. There's just so many genes and so many factors involved that actually is, if someone is mentally unwell or ill, then actually they've got to that point where they're functioning is really quite severely impacted. So the majority of the population, we want to worry about maximizing their mental well-being and their mental health. But when we think more specifically about mental illness and disorder, we're thinking about the more extreme end of struggling with functioning.
That's right. So your message is that all of us need to, especially as parents, take care of everything and look for balance. I think that comes across very strongly in the book. The concept of looking holistically at our lives and the quality of relationships in them and the activities that we enjoy. It's not just sort of thinking about those mental health disorders where a child might end up seeing a clinician. It's about all of that lovely proactive and preventative work that is so important.
Exactly. And what we find, especially in specialist services, is that what triggers somebody to develop a disorder, there's so many other factors involved, as well as kind of the biological. So it's also taking into account, what is the social context around this young person? You know, have they just split up with a partner? What is their attachment relationships like? And then, you know, what's the educational landscape? How well are they supported? And then all psychologically, how are they able to think around problem solving and things like that? So it's really a kind of a multifaceted formulation that we try and work to when we're considering how to improve this young person's mental health.
And I think it's very helpful for educators and parents that the book's aimed for, to think about that whole matrix around the young person. So the pressure's not just on one member of pastoral staff in the school to sort out somebody's problems, right?
Yeah.
It's about how all of those systems are working around that young person. And it's nobody's fault. It's all about thinking about the quality of how can we amplify the things that feel good in that child's life and work together and collaboratively. And I really like, there's a diagram within the book where you help young, a lovely thing, I think you model that you might use in clinical practice, which I think educators can use and even parents, just mapping out who's there for me. You know, what does my psychological army look like? You know, that lovely diagram where you can put the family members, the friends.
Yeah.
And you give us the sense that things can change and sometimes friendships will drop off and sometimes there's a lovely rhythm to how you describe that.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. So how we often do it, especially when people are really struggling with their mental health, because it can be a really isolating period, like, for example, if they're really struggling with school and relationships, is really to help them see, put them in the middle of a set of concentric circles and see who's that support network around the young person. And it's not just about having a specialist mental health therapist working with them at that specific time. It's like looking at the wider support network around them. And as you say, what a young person's network will look like at the age of 3 is very different from when they're 13. And that, there's nothing wrong with that. And also, just another thing that I want to bring in that I'm being increasingly trying to get across is where we sit in terms of the evolutionary framework, because this has a huge impact on how we think about mental health nowadays in terms of, you know, what were we as, you know, as a human, a social species, how have we evolved over several generations, and how have we evolved to sleep, how have we evolved to eat and to move and all of these things, and especially technology, because that's been the biggest shift in the last generation that I've seen. So kind of taking all of these factors into account and thinking holistically, I think, is really helpful sometimes, because you sometimes when you just get this problem, oh, this little lad has a specific problem of sitting still in the classroom. Well, actually, were little lads at the age of 6, have we evolved to sit still in a classroom for 8 hours a day? Was that child, have we evolved for them to then, if they're really struggling, just look at a screen, for example? It's like thinking about all of these things from an evolutionary perspective as well. So trying to bring that side in too, I think, can be quite helpful.
I think as well within that, I think it's very exciting for educators to be given permission to innovate within the classroom. You know, if a child is struggling to sit still, traditionally, they may have just communicated that message to the parent who's thinking, well, what does that mean? Is that good? Is that bad? You know, and I think there's space to innovate, to try new things, to think more broadly, again, collaboratively. And that's why I like the idea of that book targeting those parents and educators simultaneously.
Yes, yeah. And I think increasingly what we are seeing is that a lot of parents are feeling disempowered, that actually the mental health space is a really specialist space, whereas actually a lot of parents, armed with common sense, and what I'm trying to also underline is just how powerful that parental relationship can be, the attachment relationship being really, really much more important than any kind of specialist intervention, that nurturing that and thinking about as the child grows up and evolves, what do they need from that relationship? What other key relationships are helpful? So that's why the whole middle section of my book is about kind of relationships in that kind of context. So really kind of trying to help parents to feel, actually, I have got the skills, I can really provide support, and I know when to get help if it seems to be beyond the difficulties I can manage within my own network.
Two key concepts I think that I've pulled out of the book that I think are very helpful to parents is the idea of good enough parenting, which I want to dwell on a little bit, and also maybe something parents aren't more familiar with, and that's parenting sensitively. And I thought if we could be nice to hear you talk a little bit more about those concepts, because they're incredibly reassuring.
Well, actually, yeah, so that's the concept of the good enough parent came from Winnicott's the good enough mother, and back from that, all that early attachment research being so key. But really trying to empower parents to think, actually, it's not helpful to be a perfect parent. We all make mistakes, and children learning through seeing us making mistakes and then reflecting and repairing over a period of time is actually more helpful. If you provide a really perfect, not put a foot wrong, then that is not a really optimum environment either for a child to develop. So giving parents permission, actually, as you parent, there's different, that, you know, you can get swamped with all the parenting literature. But as you say, you parent sensitively and try and listen to the young person and follow their developmental trajectory, be interested then although it is one of the hardest jobs in the world, it is a lot more about kind of going with the flow rather than thinking that you necessarily need to be in an expert space. And we're all learning as we go. No child comes with a manual of exactly what they need. And you have to figure out what each child needs as they develop, because each child is different. I mean, I've got three children, and like, especially the first two are just so different personality wise. What each child needs is incredibly different from you. So you've got to really kind of change yourself, and each relationship will be different, but it's about really trying to learn together as you go along, trying to be sensitive to their needs. And not even experts get it right all the time. So it's just giving yourself permission to make sure you look after yourself as well. That's one of my key messages for parents, because it is such an incredibly hard job. But getting the support around you, making sure you are looking after yourself, but realizing that actually being perfect isn't something we should aspire to.
That's right. And I mean, it is reassuring. And I think that we're always sharing a tooled-up tip, which is to just be caring and curious with your children. Just be interested. And one of the things over the years I've worked out is that really asking great questions can be good parenting. You don't know the answers, but you're showing that you're interested and you want to learn more. And so there, I think what you're describing is flexibility. There's a lovely flexibility in your approach, which is very forgiving of ourselves, and it's openness and it's flexibility. And so it's willingness to ask and care and show.
Yes. And also learn from our young people. We're learning together as they develop. And I quite like the analogy, and I talk a little bit about it in the book, as parents as gardeners rather than carpenters. So there was that old-fashioned view that you would mould your children according to, you know, what you thought they should become. But actually, we don't know exactly what their combination of genes will throw up and what their develop, you know, what traumas they will experience, what their developmental pathway will look like. So all we can do as parents is plant the seeds and try to give them as optimal conditions as we can to develop, you know, sunshine, warmth, water, all of these things, and then see how each plant turns out differently and try and respect that if we can.
Yeah, I love it. I'm always using gardening metaphors. My favourite chapter in the book, if you don't mind me saying, was chapter 8. Which is about connecting with children and young people. And this is probably the most asked questions we get in Tooled Up from parents, about sort of how do you know how they feel, and how do you get them to talk to you, and how do you get them to open up? And I really love this chapter because it's very beneficial for staff, and school staff are coming across children who are telling them things, who they're worried about. And, you know, it's a big responsibility in a busy school to be able to speak to a young person and hope that they're able to, you know, open up safely. So this is it's a beautiful contribution, because hearing from a psychiatrist about how you do that is really invaluable. And you've said that connecting with young people is an art that needs constant attention. And I love that. It's something we can work on, isn't it? But it begins with empathy, doesn't it? And the attunement to their developmental age. So tell us a little bit what that might look like in terms of parenting.
Yeah, I mean, I think often parents or people in caring positions often say that they feel more comfortable working with children or young people at different ages. And some people really love the nursery stage. Other people seem to kind of bounce off teenagers more. But I guess the key thing is, as your own child develops, is just following what their pathway is. And if you see people that are around you that are particularly skilled at connecting with children at a certain age, you can learn from them. You can look around them, talk to them, and see what skills are they doing. If you're running out of ideas of how to get along with a toddler, look, you know, pair up with groups where people are using more exciting ideas and developing that. And it's really just continuing to listen to the child and trying to learn, as you say, asking open questions and often being alongside them. And if they are struggling to communicate, because we know that a lot of young people do go through periods where they're struggling to communicate, think about creative ways that you can open up those conversations. And it might be that oftentimes being alongside the young person, especially when they're in their teenage years, is much more fruitful than trying to have this kind of direct conversation across the table or whatever, that often parents say to us, it's when we're driving together, going somewhere or walking together or doing something together. That's where these, you know, more helpful conversations can happen. So it's really making sure that you're always giving them, you're trying to develop that one-to-one time and time with them and other family members. And it's not that children need you less as they develop, it's they need you differently. And it's trying to be in tune with that and trying to follow their pathways and just try to show your support. And as I say, if they do have communication challenges, and a lot of neurodivergent people will, it's also thinking about what other ways can I facilitate communication? If it's not verbally, are there other things that we can do? Creating cards, you know, doing things together, texting, using technology creatively. So really thinking outside the box and thinking the expression about taking a village to raise a child. I think we are increasingly fragmented in our, you know, individual family groups, that oftentimes it feels to a, especially like if you're a single parent, it feels like it's all on you, but really thinking about who else in that network can help provide support. So if you feel that there's a period where you might have lost that connection a little bit, who can you enlist to help support you at that point? So I know that a lot of people really struggled during the lockdowns. Maybe they were really intensely with their parents for a period, but then sometimes asking for a family member who's just sitting outside of that immediate bubble can really help to make that connection. So it's fostering those networks as well.
And thinking about our own social support network. And I love the idea of role models. I think everybody listening to this can think of one parent who you really admire, or a teacher who's amazing at speaking to children. And thinking about what it is, the one that I've got in mind, the way she speaks to children with so much respect. She's an early years educator, was really striking, and commenting on what they were doing and the way in which she used her body language and her face and her tone. So we all have role models, don't we, for that kind of thing?
Yeah, and learning from those people, and sometimes also enlisting their support if you know that they can help to get a concept across where you might struggle, is really thinking in the broader network, who can help me to get these kind of parenting or communication needs met?
Okay, so moving on a little bit to educators and pastoral support. So it'll come as no surprise to you that, you know, we work with lots of schools where pastoral staff face many issues on a daily basis. But increasingly post-pandemic, things like really where staff can often feel out of their depth, you know, encountering things like suicidal ideation, even in young children, or self-harm in primary school children. And I just wanted to hear your response to, you know, if you were that member of staff hearing, maybe being that trusted adult, and you're hearing very scary things from very young children, what's your best advice? Educators are very interested. They want to do a great job. They want to help that child feel very supported, but they want to know they're doing and saying the right thing. And I was very interested in what you would consider to be optimal in terms of that dialogue at that moment where a child or a young teenager might open up to that trusted teacher.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is increasing training in around mental health first aid, which is helpful. But there's some really helpful concepts around trying not to panic and nurturing that relationship that you have, because it's through relationships that young children will develop confidence and feel supported, make sure they feel heard. And it's really thinking about the risk in more detail, because oftentimes when you think, oh, a child wants to kill themselves, you know, there's this kind of jumping up and panicking. But it's actually really thinking through and breaking that down in terms of, well, actually, is this more of a cry for help from this young child? Do they understand what they're saying? And then just understanding that in more detail. But it's important as well for staff to feel supported themselves, so to have some supervision around them in terms of their work, because it's really hard work. I am pleased to hear about the increasing coverage of the mental health support teams that have started to be rolled out. There's quite a lot of coverage in some areas now where there's staff that are coming from CAMHS and providing supervision around the two pastoral staff as well. So I think there is some movement there in terms of increasing recognition that a lot of school staff are at the sharp end there, and they need support around learning to manage risk and learning to think about how to optimise functioning, talking to the class teacher, talking to parents, really thinking about the network around the child. And oftentimes, so the thing that I often say to medical students as well is that the big difference in children and young people's mental health compared to adult and older people's services is that we're often dealing with a system. We're not just dealing with a, you know, disorder in an individual child. There's a lot of layers around that child. And the more that you can really understand the network around the child and what's going on in their life, what have been the life events, the traumas, what's going on for that child in the system, who are the key supports around them, and really helping to bolster them, rather than just panicking, oh, is this child kind of mentally ill or something like that? Because oftentimes it is more just really understanding that kind of network and making sure that they do have as many consistent adults around them that they feel connected to and feel are listening to them and taking them seriously as well. Obviously, if they say something that makes you worried about risk, then it's about escalating that through the appropriate safeguarding pathways, but really showing them that you can consistently hold their distress, which I think is important.
So a lot of people asking about waiting lists. So we're obviously, you know, this podcast is broadcast more widely, so waiting lists will be different in different contexts. But it's very hard, isn't it, for parents whose children, some children are in extreme distress sitting on waiting lists. And, you know, it's really hard, isn't it, for parents to know what to do when they have followed appropriate pathways. You know, I think at the very least, you know, your book can help them feel like they're doing the right things while their child is waiting for clinical help.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. And I think in the UK, it does. There is that postcode lottery, and there's a lot of regional variations, and also which services are commissioned to children, young people's mental health, which ones are commissioned to paediatrics. So there is this huge kind of regional variation as well. And it is really hard for parents often to navigate these systems. I think what is helpful, though, is that we are seeing increasingly there's kind of initiatives, so kind of more resources around helping parents to realise that they have got a lot of resources, that it's not just waiting for that black box label at the end of the line. There's a lot that can be done in the interim as well around, for example, you know, if there's a few years wait for a neurodiversity assessment, you know, for an autism assessment, actually you can already start using a lot of the resources from the National Autistic Society to help you to manage your parenting differently. There's a lot that you can do in the interim if you're connecting with school and put in the plan. You don't need an educational healthcare, you don't need a diagnosis necessarily. So there's quite a lot that can be done. So it's about realizing, okay, at the tip of the iceberg, there are some things that it's important to pass on to mental health specialist mental health services when you think there is a really severe problem. And I think increasingly services are getting better at triaging, you know, what is a really huge priority in terms of risk or needing immediate support. But I guess for those other cases, I think it is incredibly difficult for families. But just coming back to the points about what there is a lot more that you can do, and you can empower yourself to deliver support even without that more specialist input. Because even when you get to the point where, for example, you've had a diagnosis or you have a therapist on board, it's not to say in all times that that will always answer the problems either. Because we know a lot of children, young people who are assigned a therapist will really struggle to connect with them at that point as well. So a lot more of the work can be done around the system rather than with the individual.
Yeah, I really like that idea of all the things you can do while you're waiting, you know, because I love the idea of not waiting for the antidote to come, because it's about a whole systematic approach, really, and thinking about parents being very proactive in the ways that they can be, as much as supporting them to do that. I have a little compliment for you. So we have a parent who, bipolar disorder is probably maybe something people aren't familiar with, but we had a parent who read your book and found it really helpful because her partner has bipolar disorder and her child is being assessed for it. And your chapter 14 apparently was really enlightening. So thank you for that on her behalf.
Thanks for that, because that's an interesting point about bipolar as well and how we are, you know, in mental health services, we do go through phases where we get inundated with requests of, is my child bipolar? And a lot of people kind of misconstrue or feel that if their child's struggling with emotional regulation, that therefore they're bipolar, whereas actually the definition often only is much stricter. You need to have had a depressive and a manic episode, and that's often only like in later adolescence, early adulthood, that you can actually say that. Whereas we do get a lot of requests from parents, from kids in their early teens, where you do get that emotional variation and they think it may be.
And she said, you know, it's very helpful, even though it's just common sense to you. But, you know, being sad at times is healthy, and you've written, and part of the range of emotions we all feel. And we vary in terms of how naturally optimistic we are. However, sadness that persists, sadness that gets in the way of us doing things is not normal. And depression, for example, is more serious than being just sad. So I love the way, it's quite a brave approach, but you've been quite crystal clear in that chapter on what things are or aren't, because I think that you might watch a storyline in a soap opera and think your 15-year-old is bipolar, when actually there are very stringent criteria that psychiatrists.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually, that whole mental health literacy piece is really important. And I think that your book highlights that quite well.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've got a few parent questions for you. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine, yeah.
So one of them, you're not going to be surprised to know there's a question about phones.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So, yeah, there's been a book that's been published about young people's anxiety and social media and mental health. I'm hoping you and I'll be in agreement, but it's about really, you know, are phones to blame for increasing levels of mental health issues in teenagers? So let's hear what you've got to say on that.
Well, I think there's a combination of reasons why I think we've gradually seen this increased amounts of mental health disorders in recent years. And I certainly think that technology has a part to play. I think there are other factors. For example, we're getting much better at recognising certain conditions, especially neurodiversity, which I think was much less on the radar kind of 10, 15 years ago. But I am increasingly concerned about kind of phone use. And I've recently seen the movement around the smartphone free childhood. I'm following that with great interest. I've got a child who's just started secondary and we've held out and we haven't followed the crowd and bought him a smartphone. So he's got an old retro Nokia phone to call us if he needs, because obviously he's increasing in terms of independence. But I have in mental health services, I've just seen so much in terms of concern of young people's technology use and how addictive it can be. And I've written quite a bit about that in the book as well, that obviously most of us professionals take quite a balanced approach to technology. I mean, we try and say that there are lots of benefits as well, and people, especially with more unusual conditions or really struggling to get out into the real world, are able to now connect where they weren't able to before. But I am increasingly worried about some of the trends coming through, young people being groomed, WhatsApp groups being hijacked, people getting notifications all night. And my particular concern has been around sleep, because I've also been following the sleep literature in the last 10 years, because that has such a kind of a bi-directional relationship with mental health. And what I increasingly see where young people are asking me, oh, doctor, can you give me a sleeping tablet? Because I'm really struggling to sleep. What we're realising is the majority of these young people are taking their phones into their bedrooms, not turning off the notification. If they can't sleep, they're looking at a screen, which is really impacting on their sleep and things like that. And what they're exposed to, you know, when you look at the literature of how many young people are exposed to technology, I think the majority by age 14, So there's quite a lot, and even parents really trying to put controls in place around it, sometimes it is quite worrying, the trends around that too. So I am quite concerned about technology. I do think that technology is not the only reason for the increase in mental health difficulties. I think the pandemic had a part to play, especially in certain conditions. And I think, as I say, the recognition is getting much better in the public, and also celebrities coming out and saying that they're struggling with their mental health has been helpful, because then that's a role model for young people to be able to realise, you know, the stigma is reducing, I think.
And just returning to that point about, it's complex, isn't it, how bi-directional the relationship is between sleep and mental health.
Yeah.
But I remember post-pandemic, there was a psychiatric journal, a big paragraph in it, saying that sleep deprivation was predictive of virtually every condition in the diagnostic manual that psychiatrists use. And it included things like post-traumatic stress disorder, ADHD also. And I've always wanted to ask a psychiatrist about that. That was obviously a journal article written for psychiatrists. But what does that mean, that word predictive? It doesn't mean causes, you know, sleep deprivation doesn't cause ADHD. It doesn't cause post-traumatic stress disorder. But what would you take from that particular comment?
Yeah, I think it really increases the risk, because if you're not resting your brain effectively, if you're not using because sleep is not just a passive process. There's a lot of activity going on in our brains when we're sleeping. It's like the brain's housekeeping. It's laying down memories. It's helping us to function as best as we can. And if we're struggling with our sleep, then that's really going to impact on our functioning, and it's also going to impact on our vulnerability to getting a mental health disorder. And as we know, with most mental health disorders, there's very few where it's very clear that you'll get, you know, even if you've got all the genetic loading, that, you know, it's you're really, really at risk from both sides of the family, then whether and at what point you become mentally ill is also dependent on all of these other factors around you. So how well you're looking after yourself, how well you're sleeping, eating, how well you're functioning generally. So I think that what we're seeing is that as sleep quality has reduced significantly, then that is really increasing the risk that you are going to become more unwell and you're more vulnerable. And not only to mental health difficulties, but it's interesting when you follow the literature how almost every physical health problem is also impacted by poor sleep. Because as well, what we're realising with a lot of physical health problems as well too, is that there is this impact on in terms of our immune system and how it's being triggered. And that has an impact both on things like depression, but also your risk of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, all of these things. So if we're able to really optimize or look after our body functioning as well as we can, then we're less likely to become unwell. So that's how I interpret it.
And to sort of a certain extent, you've mentioned genetics quite a lot. So there might be something latent and
yes,
that we're genetically predisposed to, but even things like particular, you know, social media, appearance-based social media. We know from Tracy Wade's work in Australia that where young women have a genetic predisposition to an eating disorder, some of that content can be triggering. And you're saying kind of the same thing with sleep deprivation, that it can sort of push it over the edge. In itself, it doesn't cause the mental health disorder. That's not how it works. But it's another little nudge.
Yes, exactly. So if you think about what increases your risk to a particular condition, there's so many factors involved, like whether you've had a relationship breakdown, how supported you feel, all of these things, as well as how's your body able to function, how you're looking after yourself. And when you get that trigger, it will vary hugely depending on all of these other factors around you.
And I think a lot of parents, you know, who another question for you was from that family where they had mental health, sort of, you know, bipolar disorder was running in the family through a couple of generations. And they wanted to know if you have words of hope and optimism about outcomes, you know, if there is a scary genetic predisposition to particular things.
Well, I guess most of us will be predisposed to some kind of genetic increased risk in some area or another, but it's about really trying to maximize our chance of health and functioning despite that. We can't really change our genes and our combination of genes, but we can really try to work with them and try and make sure that, and this is why I'm really emphasizing to all families about all these pillars around how to optimize your health. So the movement is really key. So I think that also has an impact on sleep, as does nutrition. So all of these things, if you try your hardest to optimize them, you can have really, you know, people have really great outcomes, even with severe mental illness, even with the most severe mental illnesses, people do amazing creative things. And what I often say when people have a diagnosis is, now, I guess we do have the internet at our fingertips, just go away and have a look. For example, if you've got a new diagnosis of ADHD, how many creative people have had that and how that's helped them. And people are increasingly writing books about their experiences too. So it's get a role model if you feel isolated. Also connect with those communities around you, for example, Bipolar UK, the forums and things like that, to see how people are managing to navigate those journeys, because we all have our different life journeys, and it's how do we make the best of the hand that we're dealt, I guess. And there is a lot we can do. You can either be fatalistic and say, oh no, I've got this terrible family history, or you can say, well, actually, I've inherited some positive things and some risk factors. How do I make the most of what I have? Yeah, and that's the approach we try and take, I think.
Well, that is a wonderful note to end on, isn't it? So I think we've taken up a lot of your time. And just to reiterate to everybody listening, and Dr. Simmons's book is called A Guide to the Mental Health of Children and Young People. I'm holding it right now, and it's very easy to get. You can get it anywhere on any online bookstore, can't you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time and congratulations on your book. And it's been brilliant speaking to you. And Atul.parents parents can enjoy a whole webinar with you answering their questions if they go into the platform. So we'll signpost them there. Thank you so much, Dr. Simmons.
Thank you, Kathy. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.